Okay. Thank you, David. And so this salt will again be essentially what, in my opinion, were the highlights of the conference that we had about 10 days ago or so. And I think it is fair to say that this field, and especially the theoretical activity in Bose-Einstein condensation of cold trapped atoms, started with the Big Bang about 3 years ago with the experiments from the Gila group, where they have beautifully demonstrated the Bose-Einstein condensation of rubidium atoms. And ever since that time, I think, in most of the conferences, at least that I've been to, most of the exciting results came from the experimental side. So I think in practically every 6 months, we hear about at least two or three new results, which previously were thought to be very difficult to get and so on. And I think this conference was not an exception, and again, this is a personal view, that we heard about quite a few exciting results, and most of them, again, from two groups, one, the MIT group of Wolfgang Ketterle, and the Gila group of Eric Cornell and Carl Wieman. So again, this talk will, I think, will emphasize those experimental results and try to put it in context with what kind of theoretical issues they bring up, or what kind of theoretical proposals they enable, what kind of theoretical proposals that have been made previously are enabled with these new experimental results. So with that in mind, I'd like to start by essentially dividing the theory effort on DEC into two rough groups. The first one I would call the quantum kinetic approach. And the goal here is very ambitious and very annoying. Okay. So the goal here is to understand the growth and formation of a condensate. So in principle, what one would like to do is start out with, let's say, the atomic gas above critical temperature and a certain cooling mechanism like evaporative cooling at work. And as cooling proceeds, we would like to be able to describe how the condensation takes place and how we end up with the Bose-Einstein condensate. And this certainly is a very difficult problem, partly because of the large number of particles and modes that enter the problem of describing the whole dynamics. Now, the second group is that the theoretical efforts that is based on Gross Pitayevsky equation, so GP equation. Now, this equation is valid when we practically condense all particles, or most of the particles, into the ground state, or let's say, let me write it in a better way. Most of the particles are condensed . So at this point, of course, there isn't much need to worry about how the condensation takes place, or the growth of the condensate. We have the condensate, and the question to ask is what kind of interesting physics we can do, or what are the things that need to be understood, and things like the condensate wave function, the ground state wave function, the collective excitations of the condensate, and also excited states such as the vortex state. So these questions or these the physics associated with these issues can be addressed using the Gross-Pitevsky equation, which is a nonlinear Schrodinger equation. So it seems like, at least in my opinion again, and my colleagues could disagree, there are these roughly two lines of effort. And again, I think this Big Bang in 1995 also defined where most of the theoretical effort went into. Before 1995, before we had the condensate, I think most of the effort was dealing with the growth and formation of the condensate. And there were issues whether how long it's going to take to obtain a condensate and so on. But once we obtain the Bose-Einstein condensate, then it has become more interesting or probably easier to study the properties of the Bose-Einstein condensate itself. So I would say that most of the theoretical activity has, since 1995, have focused on the Gross-Pitevsky equation, whether time-dependent or time-independent version. And, of course, this is not to say that the efforts on quantum kinetics have ended. Actually, on the contrary, there are still some controversies around, and we have heard some beautiful approaches during this conference, for example, by Crispin Gardiner and Peter Drummond. And however, again, I think there were in total about 4 faults out of 26. And that, and in addition to the fact that all of the experts in this field are in the audience, I will not concentrate on the quantum kinetic approach. And I think if you want to learn more about this, I think there will be seminars, the BEC seminars, dealing with the kinetics, probably by Yuri Kagan, Crispin, Peter, or Peter Drummond, or Peter Zoller. So my talk would be essentially loosely based on Gross-Pitevsky equation today, and what kind of new results that we that have been obtained that can be understood within the framework of Gross-Pitevsky equation. Okay, so what is the Gross-Pitevsky equation? It is, as I said, a simple nonlinear Schrodinger equation. That describes the dynamics of the condensate wave function psi. So in the time-dependent version, we allow for a general time dependence for the wave function psi, and this is the time-dependent Gross-Pitevsky equation. And in the time-independent version, we just assume a simple exponential time dependence proportional to the chemical potential, and then we obtain the time-independent Gross-Pitevsky equation. Okay, so
this is what, mean field theory?
This is a mean field theory, and I'm coming to what it means and how it is derived. So what goes into the derivation of the Gross-Pitevsky equation? Yeah?
What about a damping term and fluctuation?
No, this is, again, that will also come in the when we discuss when this is valid. This is essentially a T equals zero equation, which you should be applying when the temperature of the gas is much smaller than the critical temperature. So there is no damping, strictly speaking, in this equation, but there could be instabilities since it's a nonlinear equation, which actually have attracted some attention. And well, a finite temperature, yeah, I mean, then you have to extend this formalism. But as it is, so you have to go to Hartree-Fock-Bogoli-Bohr equations to take into account the effect of thermal fluctuations, which is maybe a step further. And, I mean, there certainly has been efforts on that, and I was going to come to that. There was one so-called outstanding issue and discrepancy between the experimental results for collective excitations at finite temperatures, at temperatures approaching the critical temperature, and that are based on some sort of relatively, I don't want to call it naive, but sort of first order extensions of the Gross-Pitevsky equation, and that has been resolved, and we have heard about, well, we have two posters on that in this conference showing how those terms could be accounted for. But again, I want to keep things rather simple here, and I won't, I mean, I will try to describe physics that you can understand mostly within the framework of this equation. So what goes into the derivation of this equation? First of all, we assume that the interatomic interaction, which will in general depend on the coordinates of the two atoms, can be replaced by some kind of a pseudo-potential that is proportional to the delta function. So we're going to assume that the interactions are extremely short-range, but we want to make sure that this pseudo-potential gives us the correct scattering length in the scattering process. So this is the first assumption that goes into the derivation. The second assumption, as I've already mentioned, is that the temperature T of the gas should be much smaller than the critical temperature, so that the thermal excitations or thermal depletion is very small. And the third assumption is that the gas should be dilute, which we can write as n times the scattering length cube being much smaller than 1. This allows us to use the simple binary collision picture and also guarantees that the quantum depletion that we have at t equals 0 is also very small. Okay. So, now, the derivation of the equation in the... What I mean by quantum depletion is that even if we have a t equals 0 condensate, the presence of the interactions imply that to lower the energy, some of the particles have to be in the excited states, not all in the ground state. And the extreme case is in the case of helium-4, where the interactions are very strong and the estimated condensate fraction is 11.
Simply psi function, for example, in uniform case, would have some admixture with finite k. It's one of the
plus and minus.
It's not real excitation.
What you mean by the first state?
Yes, it's one state.
Yeah, it is one state.
Not in momentum, for example.
In the k equals zero state, in the homogeneous case, yeah. So the standard derivation, I mean, of course, all the derivations, I should say, start with the... That's not necessary. I will come to that. I mean, it can be positive. Okay, thanks. So the derivation, which I really don't want to go into, I just want to mention one point, starts from the full second quantized Hamiltonian and is essentially based on the Heisenberg equation of motion for the field operator psi. Now, in the standard derivation, well, I don't want, maybe it's not really fair to call it standard, but most commonly used derivation, one assumes that the field operator psi assumes a non-zero mean value. This is the so-called Bose-Brocken symmetry. And then the Heisenberg equation of motion simply reduces to the Gross-Pitevsky equation, which is, I think, rather easy to show, assuming that the number of non-condensed atoms is rather small. Now, there is an improved derivation, which is actually, which I think corresponds much better to the... And also, this, of course, assumes that the number of atoms are conserved, because to be able to fix the phase at a finite value. So, this is in contrast to the experiments, where we know that the number after evaporation stop, it's fixed, and this requires a somewhat more elaborate number-conserving derivation, and this has been done apparently first by Marvin Shirardia, who is also in the audience, later by Crispin Gardiner, who is also in the audience, and even more later by the Ecole Normale group of Castaigne and Galfton. And, yep.
Maybe some people don't want to believe you along the way. It's just a whole
question. Yeah, I guess so. The expansion parameter and the validity, I think, is especially clear. I mean, among these, I'm more familiar with the Castaigne-Dome approach, where you can see that there is a small parameter in the system, which is the number of non-condensed particles. This is number of non-condensed particles divided by the total number of atoms. So, actually, the square root of this.
Situation with introducing what you wrote, that average psi is not equal to zero. It's a reality to introduce some classical field, which is inevitably going to introduce every thousand and a number of quotations much more than unit. So it's from the beginning, from the very, very beginning, Bogolyubov proved that if you substitute just the operator of the field by classical field, C value, all correction to that is 1 divided n, the number of the particles. So it's, I don't understand what
so,
you mean. Number concerning duration.
Well, I mean, I think you know what number conserving means, that you cannot take the mean value of the field operator to be non-zero. Now, I would say that, I mean, I'm not terribly familiar with this, but if I, what I understood from the paper by Castaigne and Dom, which I hope we will hear more about, is that there are actually corrections that do not appear in the Bogolyubov derivation or in the standard break and symmetry approach.
No,
this is one of...
Magician. So he tried all time and after he made such a great step by substitute operator on C value, he during next paper he proved with what accuracy he did.
I see. Okay, well, I think... Well, actually, square root of n is the normal.
On the level of type of first
level. But on the level of observable?
No, nobody is. If you have a very small system, we could think maybe we are able to see something. But in a large and thermodynamical limit or in the large system, of course, it's not observable.
In experiments, it's common in 10 to the 6.
Yeah, square root of n with a 10 to the 7, I can imagine. 10 to the 7, right?
Yeah.
There are errors in physics. Could I make a comment?
Sure.
It's not one of accuracy, but of theoretical tractability of the problem of growth. Difficult to work out how a number of condensate atoms grows if you don't know that they're ethically observed. I don't say it's impossible, but it's difficult to get a handle on the picture of watching atoms going in one by one when in fact you don't know how many you've got.
Well, okay.
The answers agree with those of Bogolyubov, who was right.
Certainly the problem is important. The square root of n is comparable to the number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, in present condensed space, you sometimes have 10 times as many particles in the non-condensed fraction as in the condensed fraction.
Yes. I mean, well, I guess...
things have to be done.
Right. Okay, well...
I can make a different comment about this. For non-condensed systems, the Hartree equation is, of course, the basis of it is one ring.
But they're the condensed system. So the logic seems to me is somewhat different here for arriving at a Hartree equation.
Okay.
Yes, in fact, there's another point that's maybe related to that, and that is that the delta function in the derivation of the 1, that you can't take that delta function literally, in fact,
yeah.
Because if it was really a delta function, there'd be no direction at all, free function. So there's also an implicit cutoff, I think, when
But the requirement just for purpose you mentioned about delta function is only one. It's necessary that correlation length will be much more than scattering length. If correlation length is much more than scattering, you can substitute it by delta function.
Yeah, that's
it's comparable with the size,
sure.
But it's just in contradiction with source. Because if you have the source inequality gas parameter, you immediately have the
stability
correlation between correlation length.
Okay. So, I really didn't want to go very much into this discussion anyway, because I don't think it's really relevant in terms of what I want to discuss today. So, I guess I want to go back to the Gross-Pitesky equation, and I have listed here what kind of things we can analyze, or what kind of things have been analyzed. The first one is the form of the condensate wave function for the ground state. And that indeed has been predicted first numerically and then in the Thomas-Fermi approximation analytically. And the predictions, as have been checked by the expansion of the condensate, are in very good agreement with the experiment. So the theoretical and experiment, the theory and experiment agree very well. Now, there has been more activity and maybe more exciting activity in the case of collective excitations, where the assumption is that we disturb, I mean, this is coming from an experimental perspective, disturb the trap potential . So make this a time-dependent potential and observe how the condensate responds. And if the perturbation is weak, we are allowed to carry out a linearized approach. And you can, again, one can go either ways. If one wants to carry out numerical calculation, one can choose a new trial wave function. Now, let's call this psi tilde. That is the original wave function plus u over e to the minus omega lambda t plus v over times e to the I omega lambda t. And these omega lambdas are the natural frequencies of the condensate. Alternatively, in the Thomas Fermi limit, I will write it down now. Thomas Fermi limit is when we can discard the kinetic energy term, roughly. I think this is not the strict definition, but roughly we can think of it as the regime when the interaction is that we can neglect the kinetic energy term compared to that. Kinetic energy. Right. No, you will have many frequencies. It's just that you have to determine a dispersion relation for the omega. Yeah. Okay, and the Thomas Fermi limit so is obtained when kinetic energy term for the density can be neglected. And this is roughly the regime when the number of atoms times the scattering length divided by the harmonic oscillator, the size of the harmonic trap ground state is much larger than unit. Okay, so in the Thomas Thorne limit, what I started out saying is that you can convert the Gross-Pitewski equation into an equation for the density and the velocity fields, and in that way, analytically, you can determine these natural frequencies of the system. Now, how good are these predictions? That's where I want to show the first experimental plot. Oh, sorry. So, this is a result from the MIT group that we have heard in this conference. And what has been done here is that the condensate, initially the condensate is generated in a magnetic trap and then is squeezed in the axial direction by applying magnetic field pulses. So the system responds by creating this quadrupole oscillations where the density reduces in the z direction, expands in the radial direction, and one can see, again, this is time. This is one novelty in this experiment is that previously these measurements had been done by creating a condensate and destroying it for each frame, whereas with the technique that has been developed at MIT, the so-called the phase contrast imaging, they can keep their condensate intact. They apply an far off resonant field, and they measure the change in index of refraction without really causing any absorption. So they can really observe in time how the condensate responds to the initial perturbation. Okay? And they can plot the extent, let's say, in the z direction of the condensate, which are given by these points, and determine the oscillation frequency that the condensate responds at. The value defined is 1.57, essentially agrees quite well with the prediction of the Gross-Pitewski equation in the Thomas Fermi limit. And I remind you that this is a zero temperature result, and the experiments are, I guess, carried out when the condensate fraction is about 90% or so, but I might be a little off on that, on the order of 90%. So the agreement with the experiments, between the theory and experiments are really remarkable. And this, I think, could give you, unless you have seen the experimental pictures before, this can give you a feeling for how good the agreements are in general and also how spectacular the experiments are. Okay, so...
Can you explain why the frequency is a pure number? Maybe I missed it.
That is essentially due to the fact that you're now interested in a discretized system. So it's a trap system. In the absence of any interactions, what you would have is just the harmonic...
Oh, you also throw the interaction.
No, that brings this non-triviality. The fact that the frequencies, the natural frequencies, are not integer multiples of the harmonic oscillator frequencies, but these certain numbers. And this remarkable thing is that for harmonic traps, these numbers turn out to be independent of the scattering length, provided that the interactions are strong enough that you are in the Thomas Fermi limit.
What was non-trivial to me was that it's independent of AS.
It is non-trivial to me as well, I guess.
Only for harmonic trap.
If you take another R-dependent, you immediately obtain sensitiveness to the interaction. It's a privilege of harmonic.
So does this have anything to do with fancy things like interpretability and so on?
It's a Galilean. This phenomenon is also known independent of the interaction for electronic systems in a harmonic direction. And
what does that do with Gaussian invariance? Because the harmonic oscillator is practically the same, or a particle in the harmonic potential is practically the same that we've got.
But there's one thing I'll be pointed out is that
in this sense. No, you get the same conservation law.
Well, one thing that ought to be pointed out, I think, is that if you have a small condensate, say 10 to the 3 particles instead, the excitation frequencies do depend on the scattering rate, and that also agrees well with the gross Pitiyevsky.
Yeah, that's certainly a good point.
It's not just...
Maybe it's interesting for the audience. In two-dimensional case, you have exact answer without assumption of Thomas Fermi.
Yeah, it's an integrable equation.
Yes.
For harmonic.
For harmonic, but even taking into account of arbitrary interaction, because what Akas is discussing at the moment is linearization of the equation, because small amplitude. But you can solve, in two-dimensional case, you can obtain exact result for arbitrary byte-scale interaction term, and nevertheless you would see, again, due to harmonic oscillator behavior, you would see some frequency constant which is not does not depend on interaction, even in the case of strong interaction.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So electrons also be results are independent of the strength of the
Okay, well, you can also see that these oscillations that have been observed decay in time, and the experiments were also, the experimentals were also able to determine, of course, exactly at zero temperature, but the asymptote of the damping rate as one approaches zero temperature. And I guess it is fair to point out, although it wasn't discussed in any one of the talks during the conference, that this is one of the issues that have to be addressed by the theory. Now, I understand that actually it has been addressed by one or two groups, essentially using the idea of Landau damping, but this was something that was missing, I think, in the conference, even though it was discussed in private discussions. I don't know if anyone wants to add to that. Okay.
Yep. Maybe you tell that it's the most puzzled thing is that just in this case you have decreased this temperature, decrease of frequency. But what Mark discussed in Gila case, there is opposite temperature dependence, and just the existence of the opposite temperature dependence is completely open for discussion. But this trend is possible to understand.
For high temperatures, yeah.
For
this trend, yeah, finite temperatures. Okay. Well, want to stop this at this point and want to go back to the Gross-Pitiyevsky equation once again. And I guess I have already made the point, but the principal non-trivial term in this equation that describes the condensate is this interaction term, which we characterize by the scattering length. And in the successful experiments of MIT and Gila, where the elements of choice are sodium and rubidium, the corresponding scattering lengths are positive and small. For sodium, it's roughly 30 angstroms for the species that has been used for condensation, and for rubidium, it is roughly 50 angstroms. Now, as you can imagine, the basic properties of the condensate rely strongly on the magnitude and sign of this scattering length. And there are interesting issues. For example, what happens if AS is large? And I think theoretically it is interesting to discuss what would happen if this small parameter is really no longer a small parameter, but it's on the order of unity. Now, there is an experimental system where this can be satisfied, and that is CU, where the scattering length, I think, is unknown. It hasn't been measured accurately, but it is known that it is larger than 140 angstroms. So it's not clear whether it can give you this regime, which might change the way we analyze the problem, but it's clearly a gas with strong interactions. Now, we have heard about one result on cesium. I think there are a couple of groups trying to observe cesium condensation. And the most prominent, probably, or the one that has obtained results, albeit negative, is the group of Jean Dalibard from École Normale Supérieure. And the results that they have obtained is essentially negative. That is, the large scattering length implies that the inelastic scattering leading to trap loss is also large. And this prohibits the formation of a Bose-Einstein condensate or obtaining phase space densities that are large enough to see the degeneracy effect. So, of course, they were not naive enough that they didn't calculate, they didn't look at calculations or didn't do the calculations themselves. But what they found is that the experimental inelastic scattering rate is about 10 to the 3 times larger than the theoretical predictions that have been around before. I guess that's true, yeah. I mean, that's right. But I guess there are... I'm not sure what the range of the theoretical predictions for AS is. I mean, experimentally, I think this is what they can say, right? This is... experimentally, they cannot measure it. They cannot even tell if it's positive or negative. Although I guess it's believed to be positive, or most theoretical models predict that it's positive. Yeah. It's not true.
But
really?
For inelastic processes, three body interpolation, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but actually, in this case, they think they're limited by dipolar relaxation, two body processes. And that's related to the fact that they're trying to form a condensate in the F equals 4 state, which allows for dipolar relaxation. So, an alternative approach which is pursued by, I think, David Weiss at least, which we have heard about, is to try to condense in the absolute ground state using optical means, in which case it will only be the three-body processes that enter, and I guess in that case it won't matter.
Is it very integrable to the dimensions, this harmonic
dimension? Yeah.
Are there two-dimensional systems that can be achieved?
Yes.
I presume that you could trap
things. It will be, in some sense, it will be quite two-dimensional, in the meaning that it will be in third dimension, the particle will be distributed, but nevertheless, in transfer motion, will be very large distance between energy levels. So right. It will be kinematically, it will be right. Exactly two-dimensional motion, but three-dimensional distribution of the particle. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, it's realized already experimentally, but it's hydrogen, it's another type.
I think there's
yeah.
Room for constant
tension,
at constant
stability
in Germany.
And I guess, I mean, the experiments of Ted Hensch could lead to two-dimensional systems since they can obtain really strong magnetic confinement with frequencies of about megahertz, I think, or 100 kilohertz.
Qualitatively the same as
for what value it's for example, for the dynamics of the system, it's qualitative the same. You can find the scale of the question, completely scale of the question, if you've done what is the pay, all you can discuss it's interesting. It was not clear that there is that for arbitrary interaction, there is exactly one dimensional case. You need to only to all problems like connected boundaries analysis, classical scale, algebraic question. So, and then you have one.
Okay, so.
Point to bear in mind that the non harmonic tests are coming out. Which,
of course,
that's true,
personality
yeah.
Personality would not be nearly sensible.
The dimple trap, which we have for the question. But anyway, and I guess the second case, which I really don't want to go into, is the case of negative scattering length. And there has been one group in Rice University of Brandeis-Huley who has been carrying out experiments in lithium 7, which does have a negative scattering length. And there has been some results, and actually some results presented in this conference, where there is some evidence for the growth and collapse of the condensate. Now, what do I mean by that? Essentially, in the case of a negative scattering length, the condensate is only stable for a certain maximum number of atoms. In the case of lithium 7 and Rice experiments, this number of atoms is, I think, roughly 1500. Okay. So what they think they are seeing is, as they evaporatively cool their sample and go beyond the critical temperature, the condensate forms, the number of condensate atoms grows, and as soon as they exceed this limit, there is a collapse, because now it's the system prefers to be in a lower energy state and not in this method. I guess I'm not quite sure I know what the lower energy state is. I don't know if anybody knows it. It could be, they could form dimers and get injected out. Or
after that, when you have more than a critical amount, the colors are starting colors. Which is accompanied by very sharp increase of inelastic processes, because inelastic processes are density dependent, and three body recombination is the leading process. Just after it started, there is interesting consequences of that. After eating of some particles, it started to decompose.
Can you give an example of an inelastic process?
Inelastic, three-body combination, three particles meet each other, formation of molecules, and bus atoms.
Oh, yes.
And they're coming out of the system. Mm-hmm. So it's
the atom is coming out.
Coming out, of, because it's a part. Okay. It's, the trap is not trap for them. Mm-hmm. Neither for molecule nor for bus atoms. So you have decreasing of the number of the particles. It's immediately conditioned for collapse going out. And you have, instead of continuation of collapse, you have opposite.
In the negative AS case,
yes.
You're essentially dealing yes. with a minus 24 potential. But at this level, it doesn't have a ground state.
Let me say again, the situation in when you have finite volume, infinity completely.
That's
in uniform. In uniform completely.
Right.
But so if you have
right. So then, so as you crank up n, you have a
more than h omega. If you have the interaction on the particle more than distance between levels. It started for colors. But if you have less, it's threshold.
Yeah.
I will discuss tomorrow.
Okay.
It could be a confusion
Sometimes you use n for density and sometimes for number.
Actually, I've been using n for number of atoms all along. Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. You're right, yeah. I should be small. You're right, I'm sorry. Yeah. Apologize for that. Okay, so again, what I want to mention here is that given the importance of the scattering length, its magnitude and sign in determining the properties of the condensate, it is that I guess it's clear that it's desirable to have means to vary this for a given condensate. And I guess probably the most exciting, and again this is of course a personal view, or experimental news of this conference was the realization of this variation of the scattering length. So what is the basic idea? No, that's one. Tuning of a scattering length using what is called a Feshbach resonance. So these are now the molecular potential curves for two atoms that are colliding. So normally we're dealing with atoms that have very low kinetic energy and colliding in a certain molecular curve corresponding to certain internal states. Now, other internal states have different molecular curves, and in particular, there could be bound states that are close in energy to the energy of the free colliding atoms, or actually, if one can tune this energy by some means and bring them into resonance, then one can enhance the scattering rate, because essentially what will happen is that these atoms will be transferred into this bound state, spend a lot of time, that gives them time to interact, and actually in the meanwhile also allowing for the inelastic processes to get enhanced. And then if no inelastic process take place, they can lead back. So in this way we can see that if we can tune this bound state across the energy of the colliding atom, we can change the scattering length, and actually one can show that the scattering length in this case can go to plus infinity, and as the level moves upwards, then it will back from negative infinity to a finite value. So this gives us, or this gives the experimentalist, a means to change the scattering length by using a free parameter. And that free parameter, we hear that in its most convenient form would be the magnetic field. Now, there is a problem, at least in sodium apparently, not just in sodium, I think it's a general problem, that if you have a magnetic trap, you cannot really treat the magnetic field as a free parameter to change the energy of these bound states, because then you'll be changing other things in the meanwhile. So what MIT group have done, and this can be considered as a major advance in its own right, is to transfer the atoms that they condense in a magnetic trap into an optical dipole trap. So this is a really very simple trap. It's a single focus laser field. And the mechanism by which the atoms are trapped is the dipole force. This is a radio-tuned laser field which causes an AC Stark shift and lowers the energy of the atoms, so the atoms are attracted to the high-intensity region. So, therefore, in the radial direction, the atoms are confined with the focus, and then in the axial direction, it's the Rayleigh length of the focus laser beam that does the confinement. And certainly, this is more of the original shape was already a cigar shape. This is really an elongated cigar, because the Rayleigh range is in general much longer than the size of the focus in these laser beams. Once you confine your atoms in such an optical trap, then you can of course turn on magnetic fields and use that as a free parameter without effect. No. This is so-called Rayleigh range. They essentially the range over which the focal length changes by a factor of 2, I think. So if this is your focus laser beam, then let's call this omega naught the width of your focus. The Rayleigh range is when the beam waist reaches 2 times omega naught. So now the results they have shown are here, so they start off with the condensate in a magnetic trap, then turn on an optical trap while the magnetic field is on, and then turn off the magnetic field to get this really elongated, nice optical trap. So what they then do is, actually, just this single focus laser beam, it turns out, I mean, it's good enough to keep your condensate, but it's not good enough to observe the Feshbach resonances, because as soon as you apply a magnetic field, then the atoms will be accelerated away. And to limit that, what they have done is to use two other laser fields, this time blue detuned. I mean, the details are not really important, but these laser fields essentially create a repulsive potential so that the atoms can be confined even in the presence of the magnetic field using these optical traps. So what are the results? The results are roughly shown here. They can also manipulate the atoms between different internal states, which do undergo Feshbach resonances or which do not undergo Feshbach resonances as the magnetic field is changed. So the initial number of atoms is the same in these two experiments. If the initial state is m sub f equals minus 1 state, nothing happens. If it's m sub f equals plus 1 state, then there is a sudden disappearance of the condensate at around 907 Gauss magnetic field. So what's happening, the interpretation is that in this regime, one goes into these sharp Feshbach resonances, the inelastic processes are enhanced, and the atoms are lost. And they have also quantitative data on the number of condensate atoms, and they have also determined the scattering length by looking at the expansion of the cloud once the trapping fields are turned off. So the larger the scattering length or the interactions, the expanded cloud shape is going to change, so they can extrapolate and find the scattering length. I'm not quite sure, but they are fits, I think. Yeah. They are not really theoretical curves. I mean, one point is they were able to see almost an order of magnitude change in scattering length, but the large values of inelastic scattering length did not allow them to estimate scattering lengths that are negative. So they haven't fulfilled all the promises of Feshbach resonances, maybe, but certainly I think the effect is convincing. Oh, I mean, this is assuming you let the cloud expand, and the expansion, you can fit that using what you would expect from the Gross-Pitewski equation based on a given scattering length. So you fit the scattering length accordingly.
Yeah, the scattering length, the energy of release of the condensate.
But you're assuming the GP equation works.
Of course.
Yeah.
Even in that region.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that assumes that GP equation.
No, but nevertheless, its parameter, gas parameter, is very small, even for such a large.
How high do losses get? When you expect the Feshbach resonance, it should be getting losses because you can get scattering to other lengths of the rational state. So you would expect high losses.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember the numbers, but. Well, yeah, didn't know that. Okay, now there's one last thing that I want to mention. Should we stop or could I continue? Okay, so there was one other experimental result which I think relates to what I would call a sort of straightforward extension of the Gross-Pitewski equation, which has been popular and which seems to include quite a bit of interesting physics, and that is the phenomena that we can describe using coupled Gross-Pitewski equations. So if we have two species...
Can I ask a more elementary question? Can you just quickly say what is so special about these atoms? Can you do
I think in principle you can do this with any atoms. I don't think there is a fundamental limitation. Now, in terms of for example, I mean, I'm not quite sure actually how sort of current these what I'm saying to you are now, but I think at least a few years ago it has been taught that the polarization gradient cooling was essential in order to beat the Doppler limit and get to really cold temperatures by laser cooling. Now, that I think you cannot do with any given atomic species. If you have, for example, if you take calcium, which has a nice single ground state, you cannot do polarization gradient cooling. So, so in that sense, getting down to these low temperatures is very difficult. But I forgot too, but somebody told me a couple of weeks ago that there is indeed another way to cool calcium or alkaline earth elements, and actually a few groups are trying that. That's true. I mean, that's another example where you have this really fascinating cooling mechanism that is, I don't know if actually they're still pursuing that, but at least this was the original systems which was thought to lead to condensation. That is, it's called velocity selective coherent population trapping. So essentially the amount of cooling, laser cooling you can get is not limited by any fundamental process such as photon recoil in that case. So, but I also heard that there are stringent limits on the phase space density because the density of atoms, the number of atoms you can collect is very low.
The privilege of these atoms connected with two things. First, the proper transition. You have laser, which is power. It's the first. Second, which in my opinion is one of the most important, that you have very large scattering length. Because just for any process of evaporative cooling, you need to have a large amplitude of scattering. And it's a privileged position of the level, so it conflicts me.
I see.
You can be lucky or not.
You're more likely to be lucky than an alpha
line, right?
You're most likely to be lucky than an alpha line, because they have very large intervals.
Also, they have a significant magnetic moment, so they're easy to trap magnetically.
Oh. That's true, yeah.
So, some, not principle, but nevertheless, combination.
Okay, so this last thing that I want to mention is that of two species Bose-Einstein condensates, now that we understand and have studied single species, can we extend it to two species, and I'll come to what I mean by that shortly, and what kind of interesting physics we can obtain. And again, most of the interesting physics we can understand by the extension of this equation. Let me call this H naught, this N times U, and write down the Gross-Peterski equation if I have two species. So in general, the form of this equation will be psi 1 squared plus, let's call this N1, N2 times...
These are densities or numbers?
These are numbers now. Yeah, sorry. Psi 2 squared, psi 1 pi h bar del psi 1 by del t. Oops, actually, I'm going to add another term here, omega times psi 2. And the corresponding equation, so psi 1 denotes the condensate wave function of the first species, psi 2 would denote the condensate wave function of the second species, so n1 u1 2 psi 1 square plus n2 u2 2 times psi 2 square psi 2 minus omega psi 1, that equals again IH bar.
There's only the two species that are the same mass, so they need zero.
Yeah, the differences in mass can be incorporated into this, and of course, I mean, the H naughts are going to change, so let's make this 2 in 1, of course. I mean, in principle, they will have different mass, and they can have a different trapping potential as well. Okay, so there are two types of coupling in principle we can imagine in these systems, and I think both are experimentally relevant. First of all, if you neglect this interaction term, we can have a coherent coupling, an exchange term, that would describe, for example, the Josephson oscillations between atoms, the same kind of atoms trapped in two different traps. Or it could be, it could describe the laser manipulation of atoms between two internal states that are not interacting. Or if they are interacting, if they are in the same trap and the same species, then we can have a non-zero interaction term. Alternatively, we can think of a really two species system. For example, sodium and rubidium, and this was discussed by Nick Bigelow in the conference. So in this case, psi 1, for example, would denote the wave function of the rubidium, and psi 2, the sodium condensate. Indeed, we cannot have coherent coupling terms. These will be zero, but the two condensates will still be coupled due to the nonlinearity that exists because of the interactions of the two species. So I think that there is interesting physics in, that is inherent in the system. We have some of it. For example, we can describe creation of vortex states by using laser techniques. This was discussed by Eric Bolda and actually previously discussed by Ignacio Serrat in the first weeks of the conference. And later,
what are vortex states?
Vortex states is an excited state of the Gross-Peterski equation where the wave function has a well-defined angular momentum. So it will have I, and it will depend on e to the I m theta times some radial function. Yeah, it's unity or it doesn't have to be. No. I just mentioned that you can use this to create, these kind of coupled species or coupled states, condensates in coupled states, have been predicted it has been shown that they can be used to generate vortex states. Because generation of vortex states, it turns out to be not a trivial issue, I think. I mean, actually, all the things associated with vortices are rather non-trivial. That is creation, detection, and stability. And I think we have heard we have heard more about creation, which I guess is not a big problem. Detection could be a problem. Stability is probably a big problem, but we haven't really discussed that in the conference. So. MIT group has tried and failed to see the vortex state. So.
So you're not talking about in principle it's possible because you don't spare the residual and density is rather lumpy. You can have vortices which is not simple rotation, it will be not global vortex, but it will be local vortex. But what is important is it can be named global vortex.
So in principle you can have a lattice of vortices.
That's what I thought for. If you have a lattice
system. Yeah, lattice system.
Anyway, so I don't want to take more of your time. I just want to show you this experimental result, which essentially has provided us the first realization of such a two-species condensate. In the case of rubidium, where the two species are the two different internal states of rubidium. So in that case, they certainly have a nonlinear coupling due to the interactions, and also they have in principle have the possibility of a Raman coupling between the two states so that the number of atoms could be transferred from one condensate to the another. And this has been done by using microwave fields that first they create a condensate in m sub f equals minus 1 state and apply a two-photon transition to this m sub f equals to m sub f equals 1 state, which is also a trap state of the system. And they have shown that they can reliably transfer all or some of their atoms to this additional state. So in this case, for example, they have generated a pi pulse transferring all the atoms to this new condensate. In this case, they have a situation where they have a condensate in a superposition state of the two corresponding to the two internal states. Well, yeah.
So in coherent state, amplitude of scattering is different. And that's why if you are doing it, it's immediately you change intrinsic energy of the system, which is proportional just
nonlinear term to A, and they have seen acceleration.
Yeah.
When they are switching just this coupling, it's immediately started to oscillate the system.
Yeah.
Due to change of the
amplitude. I'll show that. So this is, I think, right after the application of the short pi over 2 pulse. They have a situation where the 2-1 condensate sits in the middle and the 1 minus 1 condensate sort of surrounds it. There is this displacement because of the repulsive interaction between the two species. They try to avoid each other as much as they can, but they certainly do overlap in space. And that overlap, as a function of time, it exhibits non-trivial oscillation. So this is 15 seconds after. You can see how the two condensate wave functions essentially look like. They certainly have this overlapping region and exhibit these oscillations. They have seen this over time, and this is, I think it's, 5 millisecond time frames. The whole condensate cloud, when they image both states, there's nothing interesting happening. But if they just image the 2-1 condensate or 1-1 condensate, there are these non-trivial oscillations arising from. This is the Jilla group.
They're doing destructive.
They're still doing destructive measurements. Yeah. So this is. Yeah, at any point, I mean, this every measurement corresponds to a new condensate with the same conditions, but they have shown themselves to be very reliable in reproducing the initial conditions, I think. So, I mean, it's difficult to them, but I think it's there isn't much question of the reliability. Okay, so with that, I want to end.